Good morning and welcome to a True Blue LA and Amazon Avenue crossover. With me is Brian Salvatore from Amazon Avenue, and I'm Eric Steven for True Blue LA. We are going to preview one of the more exciting series in the regular season, I think, this year. It's the two best teams in the National League, the Dodgers and Mets. They're playing three games in New York. And Brian, how are you?
I am doing well. I am still riding that Old Timers Day high from yesterday. We're recording this Sunday morning, and Mets had their first Old Timers Day in 29 years on Saturday. So I am still riding that high, and we'll talk about that later in the broadcast.
So as a quick transition from that, how many, I guess, you never know with Old Timers Day who's going to show up, but like how many current Mets do you think would be at like future Old Timers game?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think DeGrom will. DeGrom is like a very quiet, personal guy. I don't know if he would be. Maybe Scherzer. Scherzer seems like he'd have fun with it. I mean, Pedro Martinez came out riding an invisible horse yesterday, like doing the cowboy thing. So, like, you know, I don't think Scherzer's going to be doing that or anything. But, you know, I could definitely see Alonso, Nimmo, McNeil, and maybe I think Daniel Vogelbach is a future Mets Old Timers Day legend. I think that guy's going to hit like a bomb when he's 50 years old, you know?
I was thinking about this too, for the Dodgers. So, you know, Mookie Betts signed a 12-year deal. So you figure at a certain point, he's going to be back at some point. Mm-hmm. I guess the odd one. So Freddie Freeman, obviously first year, it's hard to gauge, but you know, he would probably be back. And then Trey Turner now is the sort of wild card now. Are we going to look back at his career and say this is his transition, his year and a half with the Dodgers in between Nationals and whatever team he signs with? Or if the Dodgers re-sign him, obviously, then that would be they'd sign him to a contract and future Old Timers games or something like that. But but then there's a lot. But you never know. Like, it's just good to see a lot. Like, I don't know. I guess it also depends if they win, right? Like, so the Dodgers, a couple years back, it was, or was it? I don't remember what anniversary it was. Maybe it was 2016 or something. It was some like the 35th anniversary of the 81 team, and they brought out some like players I forgot played for the 81 team, and you're like, but that's cool, like, you know.
Absolutely, yeah,
like, you know, you never know. But before we get into old timer stuff, the young timers, the current guys are really good, both Dodgers and Mets. This seems like a very fun matchup. It's a weird matchup because you know, they played back in June. There was no Kershaw that series, no DeGrom, no Scherzer. I don't remember Scherzer specifically. Was he on the injured list then as well?
He either was about to go on it or was already on it. Like, it was, I can't remember exactly when that series fell in June, but he hit the IL not long after that if he wasn't already on there.
Yeah, so Scherzer's pitching Sunday for the Mets, so he's not going to be in the series, but we will have DeGrom. Who, by the way, I am just terrified of. He just seems like a killing robot machine. Like,
yes, he and, is. He is the T-1000 from Terminator 2, essentially, in pitching form.
I was looking just at his, you know, he's pitched, what, 5 starts since coming back? And it's like when, like, Pitching Ninja does the overlays and stuff, you're like, how is like, a 99 mile an hour ball moving like that, like, shouldn't be possible. And
and how is a 92 mile per hour slider even humanly possible?
Yeah. 46 strikeouts and 2 walks. That's insane. And the weird thing is, like, obviously not at the same level at this moment, but the series might have Clayton Kershaw. So Kershaw is currently on the injury list for the second time this year. It's lower back this time. Earlier it was, what is it, the right SI joint, which is, I guess, in between the hip and the back, but it's all like the same rough area. Kershaw's had back trouble, like going back like 6 years or 7 years or something. But he's been out about 3 weeks. He pitched a simulated game Saturday in Miami. Both he and Dave Roberts told reporters it's going to be Thursday or Friday. Kershaw said he knows which day he's going. So does Dave Roberts, but neither one will say yet. So if it's Thursday, it's obviously in New York. Kershaw's on the trip with them, so it's not like he has to like join them or something. And then if it's not, it's Friday when they're back home. My gut says it's going to be Thursday, if only because I think that, so the Dodgers are going to go to like a six-man rotation once he's back, since it's September and they got like a very comfortable lead. I think they're just going to stretch everyone out. But so Dustin May is lined up with Kershaw, so he pitched Saturday. He's only two starts back from Tommy John surgery. He's looked really well. He did pitch six innings on Saturday. I think that would be a situation where they want to give him an extra day of rest. So my guess, even though it's not announced yet, is that Kershaw will pitch Thursday, which would be an awesome little getaway day thing.
Yeah, he'll miss DeGrom by a day, but that would have been a very cool DeGrom versus Kershaw, you know, matchup.
You know what I was shocked about? Because I was looking up something about DeGrom just the other day, is that they're only, I think, 3 months apart in age.
Yes, but DeGrom came up so old that it seems like he's been playing for so little. Yeah, yeah.
And it's one of those weird things where, like, you don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. Obviously, DeGrom is better now, like, by a mile, right? He's easily the best, like, arm we got going. But you don't know, like, his, you know, career numbers are what they are. But, like, is it good now that he doesn't have the wear and tear on his arm that, like, most pitchers do? Although he's had an injury history. So, like, it's one of those, like, you don't know. I guess you just take them when you can get them at this point, right? Like,
right. Well, I'm not sure how, you know, for the True Blue LA listeners out there, I don't know how aware you folks are of the fact that DeGrom was an infielder through college. Like, that's something they mention all the time on Mets broadcasts, is that DeGrom did not really start pitching until he was in the Mets system. Wow. And so there aren't a lot of, quote, you know, there's not a lot of wear and tear on his arm because, you know, you figure if a guy comes up as a pitcher, from the time he's at least 15 or 16, he's throwing curveballs and fastballs and just giving his arm trouble. DeGrom didn't do that until he was 22 or whatever it was, however old he was when he got into the system, you know. So he was – there is just far less wear and tear on the arm. However, I also wonder if because of that, his arm just isn't as accustomed to the rigors of professional pitching as, you know, other folks of similar age and experience would be. Because of that.
Yeah, it's like the old like Nolan Ryan days and guys like that where they would literally throw every day, you know, growing up and all that kind of stuff. So you just sort of build it up. Who knows? That's the other thing. Like, we live in an age where, you know, I guess five-man rotations have been going on for like 40 years probably at this point. And then there's also been like pitch count stuff. But, like, pitching injuries are still around. Like, it's, like, really – no one knows. Who knows? But, like, I don't know. It's kind of crazy. Speaking of transitions from position player to pitching, Tony Gonsolin is that for the Dodgers. He was mostly an outfielder at St. Mary's College, where he was teammates with Corbin Burns, which is crazy. And he pitched a little bit, like, on a whim because the team was, like, just depleted in college. And then – sort of went full-time into pitching once he got into the Dodger system. And he's sort of the same way, like a little bit of a late bloomer. Obviously, he's having a breakout year, but he's pitching the Monday game in Miami. Mm-hmm. So he will also miss the Mets series. But a lot of it turns out the team, both of these teams have a lot of good players.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you about your fear of DeGrom.
Yes.
Like, obviously, he is not – I think he pitched 95 pitches – in his, not his last start, but the start right before that. So, you know, he's not fully back at, you know, full strength from his coming back from injury yet. Do you think that the Dodgers are just a team that are, and the Dodgers, the offense of the Dodgers is very impressive. Are they a team that will be particularly damaged by his repertoire? Like, are they, you know, can they hit sliders? Are they good fastball pitchers? Like, you know, how do you think that he lines up against the Dodgers in terms of their natural talents?
I will say they're like incredibly patient. I don't know. Like, I guess they go through phases, right? Like, I don't know specifically like pitch type, how they're going to handle him, but like, Is Sandy Alcantara like the closest in like pitch mix to DeGrom, just given what he throws?
Probably, yeah.
Like,
yeah. So, and we saw how that went last night. So
but also like last week they've faced him twice, Alcantara, in the last 2 weekends, because the Dodgers have had this weird schedule where they didn't play the Brewers and the Marlins until August, and then they played both of them, got all of it out of the way in a 2 week span. So they actually torched Alcantara last weekend at Dodger Stadium, which was a surprise. But I think, you know, you don't expect that to happen. I just think it's more the, but also DeGrom is such, he's like when Kershaw was in his peak, where he just stopped walking people, and it was like,
yes,
they can't like wait for like him to just start missing, right? And so they're gonna fall. If they do that, they'll like be behind like 0-2 like a lot, and then that's gonna be a problem. But I don't know. Like I guess the it's less worrisome, like you mentioned, that he's still sort of early in his sort of comeback, to where, you know, he's like, maybe, what is he like? He's probably a 6-inning pitcher at this point, maybe 7, I guess, if things break right.
It sounds about right.
But I think like everyone's kind of like that, the way that pitchers are used now. So like, it's
that's
not
true. Also, yes.
Yeah, but then I don't know. Like it's just, he just seems like the top of the game. The other thing that I just started laughing because I think his FIP is like 108.
Something like
which
that,
like
yeah.
Which shouldn't be possible. Like again, it's only 5 starts, but it was like in the ones like before he got hurt last year and all that stuff. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Before he got hurt last year, and you know, I'm 40 years old and watching baseball most of my life.
Yep.
I had never seen a pitcher as dominant as DeGrom for half a season as he was last year. And I know that as a fan, when it's your team's guy doing it, I feel like you give it both too much and not enough credit. Like on one hand, you sort of write off the fandom, right? Like, oh, this is just because I'm a huge Mets fan. That's why I'm thinking this is so incredible. But on the other hand, I feel like you are, you're watching, you're thinking, like, this is unbelievable. And so I don't know if he'll ever get to that level again, but he's not that far off from it right now.
Yeah. So I'm about 6 years older than you. And so I wonder, were you able to appreciate like, young Dwight Gooden?
Not really. No. I was 4 in 86. So,
yeah,
you know, okay. I don't really, I remember like I went, my first Mets game I ever went to was in 89 and Doc pitched, and it was, I mean, he was great, but I wasn't watching every day. I wasn't a tuned in enough fan, but you know, I have friends who compare Gooden's 85, 86, 87 to, you know, to what DeGrom has done.
So he, I guess he definitely, I growing up, like I had never seen Koufax except like just hearing stories about him. And it wasn't like, it was, I guess it was harder to find like video of Koufax back then, you know?
Yes.
But like, he was the best pitcher I ever saw. Like, and I think since then, you know, like Pedro Martinez has passed him. I think DeGrom is at a level now where it's like better than him. I guess the only hiccup on DeGrom is that, and it's not really much of a hiccup because he has the two Cy Young years that were full years, but like, but then like, if you look at Gooden, he was good for a bit, but then like he was sort of spotty in terms of like, obviously he had the drug stuff and everything, but like, I guess everyone has like a small window, right, where they're great. It's just, you just have to sort of appreciate it for what it is. But I thought he, growing up, he was like the standard, like that I never thought I would see anything like that again. But it seems like, you know, I guess it just happens every once in a while.
Yeah, and you know, it's what's incredible is that DeGrom has established himself. And we'll talk about the Dodgers, I swear. This isn't going to be the DeGrom cast the whole time. But like, that the fact that DeGrom has distinguished himself so fully in an organization that had Tom Seaver, Doc Gooden, you know, I mean, the team has been built on pitching for almost the entirety of its existence, and the fact that DeGrom is standing out among those legends is incredible. You know, it's just it's really remarkable.
Yeah, that's wild. Like you mentioned with Koufax with the Dodgers, it's the same thing where I know a lot of like older folks, I think, aren't ready to say this. I just looking I guess, at the number. And I'm sure I'm biased because I didn't watch Koufax, but like, I think Koufax or Kershaw is better than Koufax, but that they're at least in the same ballpark is wild because,
yes,
like, you know, that they were both so good. So yeah, it's just weird. The other thing about Dwight Gooden I was going to mention, and since you mentioned your first game you can remember, I'm certain I went to games earlier. I just have no memory of them, like, you know, 5 and 6 and that kind of stuff. But the first game I remember, I was 9. It was 1985. It was Sock Day, and it was Dodgers-Mets at Dodger Stadium.
Oh, wow.
The Dodgers won on, I remember, Jose Gonzalez pinch ran in the 9th. Mike Marshall singled him home. My brother, Greg, we stopped at Tommy's for, I guess, chili burgers on the way in, and he had a can of Coke. And I don't know how this exactly happened, if a bee was just laying in wait, but like the whole way from Tommy's to Dodger Stadium, because we didn't eat till we got to Dodger Stadium, or maybe he was just finishing the Coke as we were walking in, but he went to take a drink of the Coke and a bee stung him in the lip. And we still laugh about that to this day. So that was great. But that series was wild because, so we saw, that was Saturday, September 7th, 1985. The night before was Dwight Gooden versus Fernando Valenzuela. Peak Fernando. So like, so Gooden 9 scoreless with 10 strikeouts, Fernando 11 scoreless. And then the Mets ended up winning in the 12th against Tom Niedenfuhr. But like, just an insane pitching matchup you're never going to see like today. But
yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I was looking another thing, I guess, about this year's teams. I think one way in that they're similar, they're the two like deepest offenses in the National League and like maybe the majors. The Dodgers are more top heavy, obviously, like Mookie Betts, Trey Turner, and Freeman they've been basically 1-2-3 outside of a Mookie Betts IL stint. It's been like every day they've been nuts, but like, the Mets have more players with a 120 OPS plus than the Dodgers, 6-5, but nobody else has more than 4. Yeah. And it just seems like going back to like the last few years when the Dodgers have been really good, is they've sort of the usual path is like just try to get as many good players as you can and avoid having like automatic outs. Right. And so it makes the lineup that much longer. But like, I say that, but then also this year, like Max Muncy was basically terrible through July and they kept playing him every day. And he was coming off of an elbow injury. He also lost his swing a little bit, but he's found it in August. He's been like better than normal Max Muncy in August. So he's kind of back. Cody Bellinger kind of looks lost. He's not coming off injury this year. He was injured last year, but he starts most of the time because he's really good in center. So who knows, but like, so maybe that is, like, I guess they're good enough to overcome that at this point, but I think that's like, that's sort of where the Mets, at least from afar, it seems like they could have like a few, you know, bad players, but they have enough depth around it to like sort of account for that kind of stuff. So it seems like that's why they're good. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I would say right now 1-7 in the lineup most days is relatively formidable. You know, Mark Canna has really come on the last month or so. In terms of his power, he was like an on base and you know, singles machine for the first few months of the season. But then about a month ago, he just widened his stance a little bit, and he said it was helping him see the ball a little bit better. And he has something like 12 or 13 extra base hits in his last 12 games now. Like, he's just having this, he's on this tear, and he's batting 7th most days. And so that's, you know, that's a really nice thing to have. However, I will say that the Mets catching situation could not hit their way out of a paper bag at the moment, or all season. James McCann has been one of the worst free agent signings the Mets have done. And the Mets have had a doozy. I mean, the Mets signed Mo Vaughn in 2002, right? So like,
sure.
The Mets have had a lot of bad free agent signings, but maybe their worst ever catching signing is James McCann. And then their backup, Tomas Nito, is a fine backup catcher, but he's sort of become the everyday catcher because McCann's been so bad, and he's just not an everyday catcher. What is extra frustrating about this is that their top prospect, and what some would say is the top prospect in baseball, Francisco Alvarez, is a catcher and is sitting in Syracuse not playing for the Mets right now.
Yeah, and that's got to be frustrating.
Yeah, you know, so I think if they were to bring up him, I think then you have an even deeper lineup. But, and maybe that'll happen in September a little bit, but I just think the Mets are being extra cautious with him, which I get. Like, you know, that's he's a valuable prospect at a valuable position. I understand all of that. But yeah, I mean, the Dodgers lineup is nice and deep. The Mets lineup is nice and deep. I would say the Dodgers have the edge over the Mets in terms of bullpen, because the Mets bullpen has not been a strength this season really at all. But I'd say other than that, maybe I give the Mets a slight nod for starting pitching because of the injuries that the Dodgers have had to their starting staff. But I think the teams are pretty well matched for this for this series.
Yeah, and that's what it felt like back in May, like or June, I guess, when they played. That was a 2-2 series, and but it just felt like it just seemed like both teams are really good, right? Like where it could go kind of either way. Like, yeah, and so I don't know. It just felt even back then. It felt like you were watching like two very good teams. So like,
yes, yeah. I agree. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say someone in our comments. I don't remember exactly how he put it, but he after I don't remember if it was after the end of the series or maybe just after one of the games, but he goes, these Mets are all right. Like, because, you know, I guess from afar, right? Like, before Steve Cohen came along, there it was obviously a lot of like LOL Mets stuff, and that's it could be lazy in a way, but like it felt like that cloud had been lifted, at least, and not that you could tell from just watching a series, but you're like, okay, this team's actually good. Like they're, you know, like I don't know, it just seemed that way.
It's funny. We have had like three different times where my podcast co-host Chris Machane and I have said like, all right, this is it. This is the end of LOL Mets. Like this is the moment. Right. And we were texting this morning and he basically said, all right, I think for real yesterday was the end of LOL Mets. I think like, you know, this old timer's day, the retirement of Willie Mays' number, we'll get to all that. Like that signals like the franchise is run by competent people now. LOL Mets is over.
I thought you were going to say maybe, but you're right about the old timers name, but also and speaking of Mark Canna, that wild game against the Phillies, was that a week ago
or like that was a week ago Sunday? Yeah.
So that could be up there too. But yeah, so
I was recapping that game and it was a wild ride. Oh, tell you, my friend.
Yeah. I mean, that's one weird thing where you're like, on one hand, you want to have your recap done, but you're also like, well, I mean, but they're down like. It wouldn't be the worst if I had to rewrite this at the moment or something. I don't know. It's just one of those.
I don't know how it started, but someone in the Amazing Avenue Slack had posted this GIF. I think it's from the show Avatar: The Last Airbender. I don't know. I've never seen whatever show it is, but it's of a guy having his cart of cabbages upended, and he says, "Oh no, my cabbages!" And so we call it getting cabbaged when you have to rewrite your recap, like when you think you have the recap written, and then something happens and you get cabbaged, and you have to. Rewrite it. So yeah, I never mind getting cabbaged in a good way, but you know, that game was just so nuts. But again, there have been a number of things like that where the Mets just they're a team built on depth. You know, for so many years the Mets idea of pitching depth was having five starting pitchers.
Yeah.
Whereas
and no more. Yeah.
No, that's it. You know, that's all you need. And the Mets have used 10 starting pitchers this year, and aside from two outings, everyone the Mets have called up to pitch has been, you know, solid, if not spectacular, but solid for them. And that's, to me, that's all you want. If you're calling up somebody from AAA to make a spot start, all you want is for them to keep the team in the game. You're not looking for a no-hit situation. You're just looking for a team. You're just looking to give the team a chance, right? And they've done that this season. The team is reasonably deep in a lot of different areas. However, because there were so many injuries for a while, their pitching staff, specifically their bullpen, is not as deep as you know I would like it to be, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, this year is similar for the Dodgers in that regard on starting, because they normally plan for like having a lot of starters. Like Tyler Anderson was like signed as a starter, but didn't have a spot in the rotation to start the season. And at the moment, he leads the team in innings, and he's like seventh in ERA or something, which is wild. But you know, they lost Bueller, they've lost Kershaw for two different IL stints. But they've used 10 starting pitchers, but only one of those was a prospect from AA, Michael Grove. He was already on the 40-man, so that sort of played into that a little bit. And it was one of those like just do whatever you can. He pitched like into the fourth or whatever. And it was, and that was like the only one of those games like this year for the most part, which is even with the injuries that you're almost like knocking on wood, because that's really hard to go. Like last year, they were basically a three-man rotation after the break for a while. And like just did a ton of bullpen games. And also the option rules were relaxed, and I mean they just didn't exist where there's no limits, so they were like calling up guys every single day, so it's just kind of wild.
You know, it's always tough. You know, I don't want to, I always say, like, you know, the guys that are playing in AAA, they're probably, you know, so many good prospects now skip AAA or only in AAA for a very short amount of time. So if you're a pitcher in AAA, that means that you are probably, you know, you're not going to be a superstar necessarily. You're a guy who grinds it out. I always feel for those guys who are called up for a day and then like DFA'd because they're not on the 40-man, or, you know, sent right back down. Those guys, those are the real heroes of baseball to me. Like those are the guys that are the grist in the mill of a team's winning season. And, you know, it's been nice to see the Mets not have to lose too many of those guys this year, although they have lost a couple because the 40-man roster construction is always very tight.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot about Dodgers Mets. We got some more stuff to get into, but let's do so after the break.
I'm Alex Heath, and I'm co-hosting Land of the Giants. This season, Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook. So far, we've told the story of Mark Zuckerberg's journey to reaching billions of users, from the creation of the news feed to the acquisition of Instagram. But such massive scale, that comes at a price. In our upcoming episodes, we'll examine how the company has had to grapple with the uncomfortable side of its power. From how to reckon with former President Donald Trump.
I think Mark in the end felt that if you're going to start saying that heads of government can't threaten to deploy force to restore order, that sets a really quite a worrisome precedent.
To the harms its own technology amplifies.
Borderline harmful, sensational content fundamentally does better, you know, under user engagement.
Will Zuckerberg's high-stakes pivot to building the metaverse work? And if it does, what does that mean for all of us? Follow Land of the Giants wherever you listen to hear new episodes every Wednesday.
Hi, I'm Neil Patel. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Verge, and I'm also the host of Decoder. It's a business and technology podcast where I interview a diverse cast of C-suite executives, creators, and policymakers. I ask them how they make decisions, what their org charts look like, what keeps them up at night, and what the future for their industries hold. We just had Hank Green on the show. He's one of the biggest YouTubers around. Here's what he said when I asked him if he could quit YouTube.
No. Both culturally and economically, I could not walk away from YouTube. It's a little bit like saying, would you walk away from America? For me, you know, it's like there's things I very much don't like about it, but I, you know, I feel a little like a citizen, and that would be such a big decision to make for me culturally. But in terms of money, no, also no. Monetization, like just AdSense, is really quite powerful.
This conversation with Hank Green was endlessly fascinating. He has so many ideas on how creators can and should make money. So if you like that clip, go and subscribe to Decoder in your podcast player of choice. That's Decoder, hosted by me, Neil Patel. Here we go.
Hey there, Allison McCaig here from A Pod of Their Own, an all-women-led podcast from Amazon Avenue, the Mets SB Nation community. I'm here to tell you about Dollars for Dingers, our annual fundraising event. Every year, we ask our listeners to pledge a certain dollar amount for every Mets home run hit during the month of September to benefit a charity we really care about, the National Domestic Violence Hotline. But you don't have to be a Mets fan to join in on the fun. You can make a pledge for your own team or your own favorite player. You can make a pledge by visiting bit.ly/D4D22 and then clicking the link to our Google spreadsheet. We are also having an in-person raffle event at Ebb's Brewery at Citi Field on September 17th at 4 p.m. prior to the Mets game against the Pirates. We will have a ton of awesome prizes to raffle off, with all proceeds benefiting the National Domestic Violence Hotline. We hope to see you all there. To date, we have raised over $25,000 for the National Domestic Violence Hotline through Dollars for Dingers. And we hope to make this year the most successful year yet. So get your pledges in and let's hit some dingers.
So one cool thing about this series I wanted to mention, it's nothing to do with baseball at all, but have you seen the viral video of Edwin Diaz's entrance?
Yes, I don't remember if I came into it late or if this is not, has it been happening all season?
It's happened for a couple of years now, but this is it went viral like a month ago, let's say.
Yeah. And so I was probably not right at the start of that month, but like maybe like within the second week I was like, and then I saw it and I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. Like, it's so cool.
So yeah. On Tuesday, Timmy Trumpet, who plays the trumpet on that song, is going to be there and said he would play out Diaz if he gets brought in for the save.
So this is one of those situations where I absolutely need this to happen. Like, regardless of what team you're rooting for, Edwin Diaz has to pitch in a save situation in that game. So just to hear that, because that sounds like it would be incredible. Like, just to,
yes,
it's already incredible as it is just playing the song, but to have that and then like, oh, the live trumpet happens, like, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I try and shout it out all the time. I don't know if anybody listening on the Dodger side here ever watches the Mets broadcast, but the Mets have an amazing booth of Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, and Ron Darling. And also the SNY production is just really, really good. They're one of the best in baseball.
Yeah. I watch them quite a bit. Mostly like it helps that they're usually on, you know, the full, like the window before like the Dodgers are on, which is mm-hmm. good. But like, yeah, great broadcast, production wise great booth. I will say I don't know if it's just in our comments or my mentions, but I think it's mostly just for national work, but everyone there's more of a hate for Ron Darling because he does TBS stuff. And
yes,
like,
agreed.
But like, people are dumb about that in a way. Like, they just assume he hates their team because of like some random thing. Like, I don't know. But like, he's definitely more in his element on the Mets games. And I think, and especially when it's him, Keith Hernandez and Gary Cohen, that trio is like amazing together. Like, you could tell they have awesome rapport and it just works really, really well.
So they started doing this a couple of seasons ago. They have a camera on them all the time. It's not always shown on the broadcast, but after a game, if the Mets win, they tweet out the moment of the game and they show the booth cam. And the other night when the Mets won on Friday night, they won a walk-off with Pete Alonso single. They showed the booth cam and Ron Darling taps Keith Hernandez on the shoulder, and they both at the same time do a slider hand motion because they were saying it was a slider that he got hit. But they have this like silent communication that's happening that you don't see, and when you watch it, it's just, you see that these guys just really know what they're like. They're just they're locked into one another. You know, it's great to see.
That always fascinates me. Like, I mean, I've watched baseball my whole life, but I am just terrible at pitch recognition. Like,
same.
It's okay. That's probably a fastball. Anything outside of a fastball,
right?
No idea. Absolutely no idea. But like, just to be able to do that in itself. But like, you think like 86 Mets, everyone's like, oh, a party team and cocaine and all this stuff. But no, they were much more than that. You could tell that kind of a like weird bond of like having played together, and you could, it's like a silent. A silent connection they have. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, and Ron Darling went to Yale. Like, you know, he's a smart dude. Like, you know, they're a very smart booth. But yeah, so I think we can all hope for Timmy Trumpet on Tuesday night. You know, just
I want to see it. Like, that's too good to miss. Like, and the fact that, I mean, I saw they put out a press release, right? Like, Timmy Trumpet's going to be there. I'm like, but is he doing anything like they, does it, shouldn't he also play like pregame just to be like, hey, it's Timmy Trumpet? Or
I believe he
like
will.
That?
He also throwing out the first pitch.
Okay, that's good.
So at least he's doing something there, you know?
Yeah, because it would be a shame to not to like waste his talents.
I'm pretty
national
sure
anthem, right? Like, or something. Like,
maybe
that.
He'll do that. That would be kind of cool. Yeah. Yeah. I am pretty sure the Mets are doing whatever they can to get him for the playoffs.
Ooh.
Like, they need to pay him. And Steve Cohen has the money. Like, put that dude on retainer for every home game in the playoffs, because that would be electric.
That's like, it's totally different situation, but it reminds me of, I think it was with the 2005 White Sox. I know other teams have used this, but they were very into Don't Stop Believin'. Yes. And to got to the point where they would just have Steve Perry at like every game, and he didn't even like sing it, but he was just in the stands and they'd show him and he's like totally into it. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. Like,
yeah.
The Dodgers, weirdly, this was under the McCourt ownership. They had, I don't remember the exact years of this, but this was probably like 07, 08. They were weirdly into Don't Stop Believing as well. Like anytime they were down late, like in the eighth inning or seventh. And they had a guy, and it pains me that I remember his name. It was like a local actor, right? And his name was Jameson Moss. And he would just like get on the dugout and air guitar to Don't Stop Believing. And that was his thing. And it got to a point where I guess eventually there was a rift between him and the organization because, like, in terms of like them like not giving him like the right tickets or something, like I don't know how everything with McCourt like flamed out. So like, but what a bizarre like window into time that was, where that was a thing that people looked forward to every game. And I don't know, it was very weird.
Was that right after the Sopranos used it in the finale? Oh. Is that why that song like came back into the public consciousness?
That's a good question. I don't remember the timing of the Sopranos. Was that?
That was like 07 or 08, I think, was when it ended.
Was that when it ended? Oh, yeah, because I was still – so I lived in San Diego until I think I moved before the 09 season. And I'm certain I was at my San Diego apartment watching that. And like a lot of people thinking their cable died.
Yes. June 10th, 2007 was the, wow. The finale. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it was right around that time. I want to say 08 was probably the Dodgers' heyday of it. So maybe it was. What a bizarre time that was.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier Daniel Vogelbach, who was mid-season acquisition and sort of, you know, I guess unheralded is probably the wrong word, but like under the radar, probably, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then Trace Thompson was that for the Dodgers. Are they the same? Like, they're not the same, like, you know, in like physically or anything, but like they seem like they're doing the same. They're just like this unheralded out of nowhere person who's like basically a middle of the order type hitter when he plays at this point.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really nice comparison. You know, I think people got overly excited about the prospect of the Mets trading for like Soto, which was never going to happen, or, you know, or acquiring some sort of huge bat. And so when the three bats they brought in were Daniel Vogelbach, Darren Ruff, and Tyler Naquin, everybody felt like, oh, well, that's a big disappointment. Whereas I think that Vogelbach and Naquin have been every bit as much as the optimist would have said. Like, they have been at almost the highest, like their highest potential has been reached as a Met thus far. You know, Darren Ruff has played less than the other two, so I think he's been less than you know either of those other guys have. But I think that's a fair sort of assessment of the acquisitions. You know, Vogelbach has just mashed righties, which is what the Mets brought him in to do. And it seems like, I mean, I, you know, I don't watch enough Dodgers games because I'm going to bed about the time that they are, you know, getting into the third or fourth inning. But Thompson seems to be doing a similar role where when he's playing, he is just, you know, I think it's, I was looking him up before. I want to say he has something like is it like a 700 slugging percentage over the last month? Something like that. He just
hit Trace Thompson off the ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he homered again on Sunday. At his WRC plus with the Dodgers, I don't have it in front of me, but it's like, it's basically like 165.
Wow.
and he's not playing every day. Like he's playing some, but he's a good defender. Like at a minimum, even if he's just like, you know, roughly league average, that's a valuable person to have, like who can
absolutely
sort of play all around. But yeah, they were in a spot in June where Mookie Betts had a broken rib in a collision with Cody Bellinger, which it didn't seem like much at the time, but you never know, like that sort of a thing. And then it was weird because last year Cody Bellinger broke a rib in a collision with Gavin Lux, but that was Gavin Lux's fault because it was like his third professional game in the outfield or something. And so like nobody knew how to do anything. But so, and then also Chris Taylor broke his foot right around that time. So the Dodgers were hurting where they started Eddie Alvarez, the two-time Olympic medalist, who is an infielder, and they put him in right field for the first time ever for a few games, and they're like, you know what, this we absolutely have to get an outfielder. So they were sort of hurting, and he was going to opt out. Trace Thompson was going to opt out of his minor league deal with the Tigers. So they were familiar with him. They had him in. He was pretty good for them in like 2016, but then he hurt his back, and he's like a year and a half of trying to get that back, and it just never worked. But so they got him basically for free. It was cash considerations. I'm not sure exactly what went in the deal, but like, yeah, like we talked about depth earlier. At that point where the Dodgers were like trotting out Eddie Alvarez for a few games and right, and you're like, it was flashbacks to last season because they tried to go with a younger bench at the start of the season. None of those players really worked out. They ended up getting Pujols, and who thrived in like a limited role, not as well as he's doing this year, obviously, but
right.
They ended up having like Steven Souza Jr. bat like 9 times in the playoffs last year for them. Andy Burns batted in the playoffs for them. Like, Billy McKinney batted in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So like this year, like Trace Thompson was a big part of that. Of like, there's been others, but like last year was a rough go for as good as the team was. The depth wasn't there. This year, the depth has been there more so than in, you know, back to like previous years. And Trace is probably the most like emblematic of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sign of just a team that is both aware of their needs and also not afraid to spend maybe a little bit more than they should have to address those needs.
Yeah,
like, you know, Vogelbach was acquired for a reliever, and now the name is totally out of my head, and I should have had this called up. But of course, as soon as I have to talk about him, you wake me up at 2 in the morning this morning, ask me his name, and I'll give it to you right away. But regardless, what I was saying is, you know, it was Colin. It'll come to me. Anyway, Mets fans were upset about the about Colin Holderman. There it is. About giving up Holderman as a piece because he was a sixth or seventh inning guy, and the team felt like, well, you know, you can find another sixth and seventh inning guy easier than you can find the long side of a platoon for DH, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's worth trading that guy, and that seems like a move that the Wilpon era Mets would never have made. So it's very, very nice to have that. And again, it's not a superstar move. It's just addressing your team's needs, even at the fringes.
Yeah, no, and that's been like a key, I would say, going like under the Andrew Friedman led front office with the Dodgers. Absolutely, like upgrading the fringes and everything, like that's been as key to their sort of success as anything. Like when they first started, it was like in 2015, that was their first year, and it's they were doing like anytime they could do an incremental upgrade, they would do it, like claim a guy off waivers, and then when another guy comes along, claim him off waivers, DFA the old guy. If right. you lose him, you lose him. But sometimes they clear waivers and you can keep them as depth. And then you just sort of keep cycling until you get a little bit better, a little bit better. I mean, it took a while, but like that's one of those things where, it's just something to like, you find yourself more familiar with the fringes of the roster than maybe you ever have been before.
Right. Exactly.
Because
yes.
of all those moves. You mentioned the Mets pickups, the Dodgers had, I would say they had a weird trade deadline. Like, obviously, they were in the mix for Juan Soto, and I didn't think it was that likely, at least now, to get Juan Soto. Like, had he been available, like in the offseason, maybe it's a more likely time. Just given some of the players that were sort of rumored to be in there, like I don't think Gavin Lux was ever like the Dodgers would have ever traded him in a Juan Soto deal. But maybe that's more in the discussion if it's in the off season or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was just it just didn't happen. But so their trade deadline ended up being pretty weird. They traded for one arm, Chris Martin, and then they traded for one bat, Joey Gallo, who was like stinking it up in New York. And you're like, what is going on? Like, but and then they also traded away like 3 different players to clear 40-man spots because they have like. A dozen pitchers, or it wasn't that many, but they had a lot on the 60-day injured list who are sort of all in this various stage of possibly coming back. So they had to clear a little bit of room to do that. But it was a very weird, like, no, this is kind of our team. Although part of it, like, they had a big lead. They're pretty much guaranteed a bye unless they absolutely collapse, like, and the Cardinals go crazy or something. But, like, I sort of get it in one way, but, like, I don't know. It felt a little weird, but at the same time, like, I think they acted like a team that didn't have to. If they saw the cost was, like, too high, they're just like, nah, we're good. You know, like, that kind of a thing. But,
What's interesting about that is I think that all three of the Mets moves that I've talked about before, Ruff, Naquin, and Vogelbach, I think they all, maybe aside from Naquin, I feel like they all overpaid slightly for that.
Yeah.
But the thing they needed the most was they needed a lefty reliever, and they didn't acquire one. Mm-hmm. And, I think it says a lot about, like, I was thinking they were going to get Andrew Chafin because Chafin he's famously unvaccinated. So I thought an American League team is not going to want him for the playoffs because the Blue Jays were in playoff position at that point. And, you know, you don't want to leave a good reliever on the table because he's not vaccinated. And so I thought the Mets were a natural fit for him, for that reason. But he didn't get traded up to anybody. So the Dodgers' asking price for Chafin must have been really high. But the only reliever the Mets acquired was Michael Givens, who has been atrocious for the Mets. I mean, just absolutely. You know, he's coming into the game now with a one run, down by one in the top of the ninth. And I have a feeling this is going to be a blowout now because Givens has just been so unbelievably terrible. Huh. And so, it's just a weird trade deadline is exactly the right way to put it. But I also feel like aside from the big swap of closers that Milwaukee and San Diego did, I don't think as many relief pitchers moved as people maybe were thinking were going to.
Yeah.
At least not as many as I thought were going to.
Yeah, it seemed like there were more. I'm trying to think of, like, that one of those was like the Rockies with Daniel Bard, like he was like clearly like a top five like reliever on the trade market, and then they're like, nah, we're gonna keep him, and then they signed him rather than like the last couple years where they didn't trade Story, they didn't trade John Gray, and then both just left, like, you know,
right, yeah.
But so yeah, there it was kind of weird. I put together like a very rough outline of what we were going to talk about, and when I put this part in about the trade deadline, it made me think like, oh, this is Joey Gallo's first time back in New York, and that's going to be like 2 days of like just brutal like coverage of that. I'm not looking forward to that. No,
I just think that I think that Joey Gallo is like low key a Mets hero because he shit talked the Yankees on the way out of town. So like, you know, yeah. I think that for a lot of people, he did the right thing there. So maybe it won't be so bad, but it's certainly gonna be brought up. How do you feel about Gallo right now?
He's pretty good. Like he's been like for the most part productive. Like I think so. It wasn't a one-for-one trade. They sent Jake Lamb off to Seattle, which is where Jake Lamb's from, and that part of that was like they wanted to clear 40-man spot. But Jake Lamb is a career, you know, he's a first baseman, third baseman, or whatever, and they were playing him in the outfield and DH, and he's not an outfielder. Joey Gallo, he wasn't hitting in New York, but he's an outfielder. He could actually play, has a strong arm, all that kind of stuff. So at the very least, they were sort of upgrading that part of it. But like he's hit like and you know since he's come over, and he's been perfectly fine. It's not like a straight platoon or anything, but he and Trace Thompson are sort of getting a lot of time together. Cody Bellinger's been sitting a little more often, giving Thompson more chances, like in center. They also have Chris Taylor back, and so this is in a weird spot where, and again, we talked about this where you're. You never want to like, oh, they're kind of at full strength on the position player side. They kind of are at this point, to the point where Edwin Rios, when he tore his hamstring in June, he had limited playing time, but he got a little bit of a run there, and he had like a streak of home runs, and he was second on the team in home runs when he went on the injured list, and they had him on a rehab assignment in AAA, and a couple weeks ago when he reached 20 days, the maximum you could have. you know, they either have to bring him up, or so they activated him from the 60-day DL, but they didn't have room for him on the roster, so they optioned him. So he'll be up, like, I would imagine he'll probably be up for Thursday's game because that's September 1st. He'll be the extra position player, but, like, it's just weird, like, how it kind of works out that way sometimes. Yeah, I don't know. It's been pretty good, though, with Gallup.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm always of two minds. I think in one way, the it's hard to play in New York narrative is overplayed.
Sure.
And I think that's, I think people say it about LA, Chicago, Boston, sort of any of like the bigger cities in the country. You'll hear people say that about the sort of the spotlight being brighter there. And certainly it's brightest in New York. I mean, New York has, you know, something like 7 active beat writers at any time, you know? And so that's a lot of reporters coming to your locker and talking to you. But I think that Gallo also became a scapegoat for a Yankees team that at the time was either early in the season they were not producing all that well, and then he was sort of the one guy who wasn't producing that well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he just became the, you know, the problem child in terms of for Yankee fans and Yankee media, and I don't think he deserved that.
Yeah, and it's one of I don't think it'll be that bad either. I think I'm just dreading the few like outlier takes that are going to happen, and
yes.
So just sort of trying to avoid that. But you're right. I think I have never covered a game in New York, but it just seems like just by sheer volume that plays into that narrative more than anything. Just because, like you said, there's just so many reporters and angles and all this kind of stuff that you're. I think it's just the volume of it that plays into that more than anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned earlier about going to an old timers game on Saturday for the Mets. The Dodgers went about, I think it was like 17 years without an old timers day. They brought it back in 2013, and it was a big deal at the time. And they that was also the first full year of the current, like, new at the time, new ownership group. Mm-hmm. So that was a thing. And then they had it for like 5 years. And I remember, like, Pedro Guerrero was my favorite player growing up, hitter, I guess. And seeing him there, I think at least 2 of those years was awesome. Like you said, it's just, you get like this flood of emotions coming back to seeing those players. It's great. They haven't had it since then. I know the last 2 years was because of pandemic. I don't know why they didn't do it this year, but they haven't done it. They haven't done it again for a while. But what are your thoughts? Let's just talk about your day at Old Timers Day yesterday.
Yeah. So the Mets had not done one in 29 years or 28 years, I think.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Like that's a long time to go without doing something like this. But the Wilpons were an ownership group that was somehow embarrassed of the Mets' history. Like it's very hard. They really, I mean, the only numbers they ever retired in their entire tenure there were the two guys who went into the Hall of Fame as Mets, Seaver and Piazza. They never retired another number in their whole ownership period, which was from the mid-80s
wow.
through 2 years ago. You know, it just wasn't something the team did. And so they brought back over 60 players for it, guys from the original 62 Mets all the way to Daniel Murphy and Josh Tolley, who were relatively recent Mets, were there as well. Jose Reyes as well. And, you know, the ceremony was really nice. And what they did, something that I thought was really classy, were like, you know, Tom Seaver is no longer with us. And so they had Tom Seaver's daughter walk one of the older players out.
Oh.
And so that way they were honoring, like, Yogi Berra's daughter was there. Gil Hodges' family was there. They really tried to honor, like, most of the important players in Mets history, which is a very cool thing for them to do. You know, I'm a little upset that David Wright did not show up. He says he doesn't feel like an old timer yet. I don't know why Jerry Kuzman wasn't there. Kuzman's number was retired last season. So I don't know why Kuzman, maybe he's not in good health. I'm not really sure. And the only other person that I was really bummed about was I am a huge R.A. Dickey fan.
Yeah.
And Dickey was not part of the festivities either.
Oh.
But aside from those guys, like almost every player you would expect to be there and then a bunch you didn't expect to be there were all involved, and so that was really cool. And then I think that the news of the number retirement got out there, but I don't think folks are talking enough about the way it happened. So at the end of the ceremony, they showed a video package about Willie Mays, and then they said, you know, Willie Mays started his career in New York, and you know, was brought over in 72 and played the last year and a half of his career as a Met. And Joan Payson, the Mets' original owner, had said to him when she brought him over that you'll be the last player to wear 24 for the Mets. And as soon as you retire, I'll make sure that's the case. And then she died before he retired. And so her heirs and the Mets leadership never followed through on that. And so in the middle of the speech, you know, Howie Rose, the Mets radio broadcaster, said basically, you know, she had promised us and it never happened until today. As of today, they will never wear it, be another 24. And they pulled out the thing and they showed them the number on the field. And like nobody knew it was coming except for, I guess, his family knew, but it was not announced beforehand at all. And so the entire stadium was like in shock when this happened. And it was just this beautiful moment. And his son came out and they read a statement that he had written. Apparently he just had his hip replaced at 91 years old. Yeah. So he wasn't going to get on an airplane and travel, which I totally understand. But, you know, this is an interesting conversation. We've been having this conversation in the Amazing Avenue Slack sort of all weekend. And I wanted to get your take on it. So, you know, I think most rational sports fans can recognize that Willie Mays is a player that is so special that certain rules will be bent in celebration of him.
Oh, yeah.
And he only played like 135 games as a Met, and you know that's not a lot. But he was so important to New York when the Giants were here, and it's important to New York baseball in general that I feel like it's a totally rational move to retire his number. And a lot of folks are pointing out that they feel that LA and San Francisco fans, although they obviously know the Brooklyn and New York teams, don't feel a real connection to those New York teams because it was so long ago across the country, etc., where New York National League fans maybe have more, not more ownership of it. I don't want to say that. I don't mean that, but just sort of a more of an emotional tether to those teams. Would you agree with that as a Dodgers fan your whole life?
Yes, and for a couple reasons. Isn't one, like, so I've never been to Citi Field. I've only been to New York once in my life, and it was outside of the baseball season. I took a tour where I saw Yankee Stadium. I think it was the boat tour or whatever, but so I haven't won a game, but aren't the entrances to like Citi Field like basically like Dodgers and Giants related? Like or something like that. Like,
so the main rotunda is called the Jackie Robinson Rotunda,
yeah.
And it has a giant number 42 statue there. The colors of the seats are green because the Polo Grounds seats were green.
Yeah.
The Mets colors, blue and orange, blue from the Dodgers, orange from the Giants. Like that's, you know, that's a part of our history as a franchise.
Yeah. No, I get it. But the main reason is so the Dodgers are. They have like a weird policy where they only retire Hall of Famers. So they still haven't retired Mike Piazza's number, which is a separate issue from this. But like, I think that's because they're both in a pissing contest and they have been for years, both Piazza and the organization. So I just think they have to like work that out before that happens. And who knows if it's going to happen. But the Dodgers, one of my main bugaboos for the Dodgers is nobody's worn 34 since Fernando Valenzuela left the team in like 1991, and they haven't retired the number. So they've retired the number like by not using it, but without giving the man the honor, right? So which is bizarre. But another thing. If you're going by just Hall of Famers, the Dodgers have a number of Brooklyn Hall of Famers like who aren't on their Ring of Honor, and mostly because they didn't wear uniform numbers, right? So like they should have plaques for like Dazzy Vance and Zach Wheat and a lot of those guys. Like those should be also honored because they do a really good job in terms of like linking back to the past. Like Don Newcomb was a mainstay with the Dodgers the last few years up to his death. Like he was always around Dodger Stadium. He always did events and things like that. And his ties were to Brooklyn, like in terms of playing days. So like they obviously like recognize that, but in terms of like official recognition, I do think they could do a lot better in at the very least, like it just, educates fans about who those players were, because like nobody know, and not that everyone has to know who Zach Weed is, you know, or whatever, but at least like acknowledge it. Like I watch Tigers games and all their numbers are like out on that brick in the outfield, like the brick wall. Right. And, but like for old players, like Ty Cobb, it just says Cobb because he never wore a uniform number. Right. Like, so, so yeah, it's just, they should do a better job. So like in that regard, I absolutely agree that the Mets do a better job of like,
I just think also history, like, so my dad grew up a New York Giants fan.
Sure.
And, you know, he kept following them in San Francisco, but he could never follow them the way he could in New York, you know?
Yeah.
I took my father-in-law to Old Timers game yesterday, and he grew up a Dodgers fan. And then when the Dodgers moved away, he became a Mets fan. Like, it's just that I think there's still enough people for whom those New York National League teams mattered, you know, whether in my life or in the life of the people around me. Like, I think that the New York sports fans – basically, I think it makes total sense to retire Willie Mays' number. And there are folks who are, a little bit mad about it. You know, we're not mad about it. A lot of folks who don't understand it or think it cheapens the numbers that are already retired. And to me, it's like, it's Willie Mays. Like, you know.
Yeah, like, for the reasons you mentioned. But even if you sort of ignore just that part of it. Willie Mays is like, at worst, like a top 10 player all time, and he's probably very clearly like top 3 or 1, you know, or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And like, so you, like you said, you do bend the rules, I think, in that situation. But also, he went to the World Series with the Mets. He was really good despite being in his 40s. And like the connection to New York is obvious. So like, why not? Right. Like,
yeah,
I think there's, it doesn't have to be like a hard and fast rule of like play here for X amount of years or Hall of Fame or anything like that. I think different organizations have different like, you know, histories, and like if as long as you're like connected to it, I think it's great. So like, I think more of that would be great.
Yeah, and I think it also just shows that Steve Cohen cares about both the Mets, like the written history and the unwritten history, unspoken history, you know, the things that the sort of the tendrils in the background and all of that. And, you know, just the fact that he's willing to just also bring Willie Mays back in the fold. Like I know that the San Francisco Giants have Willie Mays there all the time, and that's great.
Sure.
He should be, that's very important. But Willie Mays does matter to the Mets.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think he was at the opening of Citi Field when they brought back like most of their history. I don't think Willie Mays was there. And like maybe they asked him and he said no, but it just seems to me like let's make sure we're honoring, especially while he's still alive. Like, you know, let the guy get his flowers while he's still alive.
For sure. And like also it's one of those where it doesn't hurt anything to like keep the doors open, right? Like to just keep, instead of like closing offering, he wasn't a real Met, you know, like it doesn't make any sense. There's he meant a lot to a lot of people while he was with the Mets, and it's great. Like, so why not?
Yeah,
I guess that's my take on it.
I was trying to think of another player that would be in a similar situation, and I really can't think of one. I guess like maybe you could say if the Tampa Bay Rays retired Wade Boggs's number, because Boggs ended his career there, and like, you know, famously wanted to go into the Hall of Fame as a Ray because he didn't want to change. He didn't want to pick between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Like maybe that's the closest comparison I can think of.
Yeah. Or because he's from Tampa. I wonder, you're going to love this. The Rays actually did retire Wade Boggs' number.
There we go. Okay.
So it looks like the Rays have only, they've retired two. Hold on, I'm looking this up. The Rays have only retired two uniform numbers. Through this year, I don't think they've retired anyone this year outside of Jackie Robinson. Can you name the other one? And this person was not a player for the Rays. So the only Rays player with a number retired is Wade Boggs. That's wild. Do you have an idea who the non-player is?
Non-player. It has to be one of their managers, right?
So I was looking at this. He did not manage the Rays. He wait, was. Wait. I, okay, I'm wait, trying wait. To think. So let's see. So
he's not. He didn't play for the Rays. He didn't manage the Rays. Was he a coach for the Rays?
I don't think so. I'm reading this. He may have been, but like one of those only like occasionally type of a thing.
Like a spring training special instructor?
No, he was around, but I don't think he was actually a in-uniform coach. I will say this is he spent the last 11 years of his life as a Rays senior advisor.
I have no idea. Who is it?
Don Zimmer.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, when he had his falling out with the Yankees, I think he went over to Tampa.
Yeah, I think that probably makes sense.
But yeah, so Wade Boggs is the only player number retired amazing. That's the craziest thing I've heard all day.
Yeah, well, that's as good of a part as any to go out on.
I suppose
a Dodgers Mets preview talking about, hey, Don Zimmer played for the Dodgers, so hey, there's a link.
There we go. Exactly. And I want to say he was a Mets coach at one point too.
That makes sense. He was
actually he might have played for the Mets. I think Don Zimmer.
Oh, I think he did actually. Maybe after the Dodgers came to LA and he went back to New York or something because he was in Brooklyn.
He played for the Mets in 62. Look at that.
Wow. Original Met. Nice.
I don't know if he started the season with them or if he came over. Or it looks like he might have. I think he did start the season with them. And then, he was traded in May.
Love it.
So, yeah.
Wow. What a. See, the Dodgers and Mets are linked in so many ways, but
they really are. Yes, the last thing I want to say is this: the Mets have a very small lead in the National League East. The Dodgers have a huge lead in the National League West. If you could throw us a couple of wins, we're good for it in future seasons or something. But
it's like making a down payment for. So wait, how does that work? So if the Dodgers help the Mets out now, is that going to translate into the NLCS? Like, if they end up playing, like, how does that work? Or is this just an empty promise? Yeah, I don't know.
I can't promise the playoffs. The playoffs are different. But,
that's fair. Yeah, I think, it's a fair regular season trade for regular season trade. Like, do me a solid now. We'll help you out at another time.
Exactly, yeah.
I love it. Well, this has been a wonderful crossover episode between True Blue LA and Amazing Avenue. Thanks for
hopefully
listening.
Hopefully this is an NLCS preview we'll be doing in 2 months or so,
Yeah. I mean, it very well could be like right now they're the 1 and 2 seed. I mean, it seems like, again, not, I don't know how big into jinxes you are, but
I don't believe it
seems right that they're 1-2 at this point. Like,
yes.
So yeah, it's going to be, I think it's going to be a great series. It's going to be a fun series. Obviously terrified of DeGrom. Thanks for listening, everybody, to both sides. If I'm new to your ears, I'm sorry. And Brian usually makes me sound better. He's our producer for the True Blue LA podcast, and he's obviously does a great job.
Everybody check out True Blue LA. I love the True Blue LA podcast, and I would love them even if I didn't work on them, but I do work on them, so it's extra fun.
Yeah, and to all the Amazing Avenue folks, have a good series, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.